Our guest today is the famous author Isabel Allende. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have come, courtesy of the Lannan Foundation, to give a talk to Santa Fans, and the whole town is kind of abuzz with this. You are an author who has sold over 51 million books.
Yeah, I should have $51 million. Where are they?
I don't know. And translated into 30 languages. At least maybe you have the 30. But you're one of the first really Latin American women writers. And you set the template. I'll try to go through these. But the first book that catapulted you onto the world stage was The House of the Spirits, an absolutely incredible read I recommend to anyone.
Well, that book I wrote more than 20 years ago in exile. After I left Chile because of the military coup of 1973, I found myself totally disconnected with no roots. I thought that my life was over. And then when I started writing this book, which began as a letter for my grandfather, everything changed in my life. I found what I was born to do, tell lies.
After The House of the Spirits, there are many books, but again, some of my favorites. This is Eva Luna, and after that, The Stories of Eva Luna, which
very is... Very difficult.
Your only collection of short stories.
Huh? Yeah, after I wrote Eva Luna, many people said, well, this is the story of a storyteller. Where are her stories? And at that time, I had fallen in love with an American, the last heterosexual bachelor in San Francisco, and moved to his house without an invitation. And so the only advantage of short stories is that you can write them in a short period of time. In a couple of weeks, you have a story. But they are very, very difficult. And so because I was living with Willie and I didn't have a place to write, a room of my own, I wrote in the car while I waited for him. And that's how the stories came. And they are all love stories because I was in lust with him at the time.
And didn't he fall in love with you?
No. He likes tall blondes.
But did he not read Love and Shadows?
He read Love and Shadows and he fell in love with the book. But he wasn't expecting me to be the writer. He was expecting someone
But
taller.
Didn't he say at one point that you so clearly believed that all things were possible in love? And so did he. And that is what attracted him to you at first.
He says that we have a spiritual connection. I don't know about that. I just like to sleep with him.
Let's go through some of the books. Again, this one is brilliant. Paula, it was about your daughter and her tragic, untimely death. Can you tell us a little about Paula and how you could possibly dig so deep and write this book?
I have two kids, and I say I have because the fact that she's dead doesn't make a difference. She's still with me. And she was the oldest. And she had a rare condition that runs in the father's family. And my children and my grandchildren have it. It's called porphyria. And it shouldn't be fatal today. It's something that can be controlled. And she did know that she had it, and she took very good care of herself. Unfortunately, she had a crisis and went to a hospital in Madrid where she was living at the time, and there was a strike in the hospital. It was a holiday, just bad luck. There was negligence in the hospital. She entered into intensive care. She wasn't taken care of properly. And then they tried to hide it. And 4 months later, I got back my daughter in a vegetative state, in a coma. And I brought her to the United States, to our home, and I took care of her until she died by the end of the year. I tried everything. Everything that medicine, science, and holistic medicine and prayer could do. And nothing helped. And I never understood why she stayed so long. She should have died at the beginning without that year of suffering. Now I know that we all learned something. It wasn't wasted that year. And it wasn't only awful. It was very painful. But there were things that came out of that year that are extraordinary. To begin with, my son and I became so close that we are like married in soul. The family became very close. I became very strong. Very few things scare me now. And I could write that book. And when that book was published, I got thousands of letters from all over the world. And still today, 15 years later, I still get letters. So I know that I'm connected to everybody because everybody has losses. It's been an eye-opener for me and a wonderful thing. And also because of the book, I was able to create a foundation to continue the work that my daughter was doing, empowerment of women and girls. And that's very rewarding.
I want to skip ahead because you have a wonderful story about a trip that you took to India. You travel to, regenerate your writing. You went on a trip to India and the woman thrust a parcel upon you. Tell us that story.
That was the beginning of the foundation. I had written the book and then the checks from the book started to come in. And I didn't want to touch any of that money because, of course, I wanted to do something that was meaningful to my daughter. But I didn't know what it was. And I couldn't write. I felt that I was in a writer's block. Someone suggested, go to India. India is very inspiring. So I went to India with my husband and a friend. Actually, the friend who made the earrings that you are wearing, Tabra. Okay.
Yeah.
And we went to India, and it was an extraordinary trip. For me, it was incredible. Tabra had been in India many times. And we took a car, and we were crossing Rajasthan. And in some place, in the middle of nowhere, in this dusty street, very, very hot, we saw an acacia tree. And something in the distance that looked like blackbirds. And as we got closer, there were women dressed in dark colors, which is unusual in India. And because it was so hot, we decided to just stop and drink water or whatever. There was no reason why those women were there, because there was not a well or a market or a town. They were just there in the middle of nowhere. And as we approached, these women came closer. In India, like in many places in the world, people don't have this polite distance that we always keep. People really get very close and touch you. And they started touching Tabra's red hair and all the bracelets, and we gave them all the bracelets. And then as we were leaving to the car, one of the women came running behind and gave me this little these rags. And I thought that she was trying to give me something back for the bracelets. I said, no, it's not necessary, no, don't worry. And she insisted. And so I picked up this thing that weighed nothing, and I sort of opened the rugs, and there was a newborn baby inside. And so I kissed the baby, blessed the baby, and gave it back, but she didn't want it. And so she turned around and sort of ran. And then the driver of the car, who was Indian, came running and took the baby away from me and tried to give it back to the women who were sort of scared of him. And the guy said, you can't take it, you can't take the out of the country. Leave it. And then they pushed me in the car and we left. And in the car, when I sort of woke up from this shock, I said, why was she trying to give me her baby? And the driver said, it's a girl. Who wants a girl? And in that moment, I knew what I was going to do with the income from the book. I was going to try to empower girls like that little baby. And that's what I've been doing for the last few years.
You have a website. I want people to know about how they can find out more information about your foundation. And your website is?
My name, just my name. And so type my name, Google my name, and then it comes up, the foundation and stuff about me that sometimes helps the journalist before an interview or students who are writing something. And people are just like the gossip, you know, they want to see the pictures or whatever.
You had said in your latest memoir, The Sum of Our Days, which we'll come to in a minute, that your daughter used to ask you this question: what is the most generous thing
To do.
Every
time, she was a psychologist. And when I married Willie, we had so many problems that I lived in therapy. I mean, the money I have spent in therapy, I could have a mansion in the French Riviera. And so I would call Paula to Spain, where she was living, and I would explain the whole melodrama. There would be a pause, and then she would say, "Mother, what is the most generous thing to do in this case?" And you know, the most generous thing to do is usually a very good thing to do. It doesn't solve everything, but it makes you feel good. And that is the motto of my foundation. The mission and the motto is generosity. Just give away. You only have what you give. I have stories. If I don't give them away, there are no stories. It's like everything else. If you cook and you don't share your food, what's the point? When I'm alone at home, I eat apples and tea. I only cook if I can share it. And like that, everything else.
Speaking of cooking, after Paula, you did this really beautiful book called Aphrodite. And it is it's just so beautifully put together. Your daughter-in-law is a graphic mm-hmm. designer, and she put, because the pictures and the fonts and the stories, tell us a little about this.
Well, after Paula, I was in a writer's block for, as I said, for some time. And then I decided to come out of the block by writing something that was not fiction. I'm a journalist by training, and I know that if I'm given an assignment and enough time to research, I can write about everything except sports, well, politics, maybe not. And so I gave myself an assignment that would be as removed from death and illness and loss as possible, to just come out, you know, of all that darkness. And I decided to write about lust and gluttony, the only deadly sins that are worth the trouble, really. And the research, of course, pulled me out of whatever darkness I was. And I started to visit the porn shops in San Francisco in the gay neighborhoods with my mother, who was visiting and doesn't speak English, so I had to translate. My mother also doesn't see very well. So she would come very, very close to these rubber things. Say, "What is this for?" And I would have to translate the instructions. And we cooked together. And she came up with erotic recipes. This was... I was very fortunate that the book was released 2 months before Viagra, because otherwise, who would have bought it? Today, you take a pill, you don't need to cook.
After that came Daughter of Fortune, again, very California-based, Chilean California, much as yourself. For fun, I just think this is such a delightful romp, but your take on... the famous Zorro legend.
Well, that's because I'm in love with Antonio Banderas.
Ah.
I've been in love with Antonio Banderas forever. And that was a really good excuse to get to know him, because he's in 2 movies, you know. And I'm still hopeful that he will be in that movie, too.
The sacrifices you must make.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now, your most recent book that has just come out this year is called The Sum of Our Days.
The Sum of Our Days is like a sequel to Paula. And it's written to her, like as if I'm talking to her, to tell her what happened with her family after she died, in the last decade after she died. And so much has happened that you won't believe it. It's a very weird family, the kind of stuff that you can't have in a novel, because it doesn't work in a novel. But in real life, it happens all the time.
Now, Pablo Neruda, the iconic poet of Chile, when you were a journalist, when you had to leave Chile, we'll talk about your family background in a little bit, but your uncle or cousin was Salvador Allende, mm-hmm. the president of Chile. September 11, 1973 is the dramatic... Well, tell us a little about your background and Chile, and then what Neruda said to you.
I should start by Neruda. In 1973, in August... he invited me to his house in the beach. I was then a journalist, a young journalist. And I thought, oh my God, the Nobel laureate wants me to interview him. So I washed my car, my little car, bought a new tape recorder, and did all the trip that was like an hour and a half, 2 hours in the rain to get to his house. And we had a wonderful meal. He showed me his collections of different things. And then I saw that he was tired, because by then he was already ill. And I said, well, I'm ready for the interview, Don Paulo. And he said, interview? What interview? I said, well, I, came to interview you. And he said, look, child, I would never be interviewed by you. You are the worst journalist in this country. You can never be objective. You put yourself in the middle of everything. You make up things. I'm sure if you don't have a story, you make it up. Why don't you switch to literature, where all these defects are virtues? I didn't pay any attention then. I became a writer much later. But now that I am a writer, I realize that I was really a lousy journalist. I could never say things as other people see them. There's always, how can I say, an angle. And I stand always, like, behind things. So my, as a journalist, it doesn't work.
In your first book, The House of the Spirits, you portray four generations of a family in Chile through all of the time of political turmoil. So I think they say about certain writers in New Mexico, there's the coyote trickster tradition that you lie to bring us the truth, that you can use fiction to bring the truth of what that family went through, especially during the revolutionary days. And you, as a result of that, now, is Salvador your uncle or your cousin? It's very confusing.
He was my father's cousin, first cousin, which in Chile would be an uncle, because it goes by generation, but here it's a cousin.
And so because of your name, you had to leave.
No.
No.
Not because of my name. I left because I did not agree with the dictatorship.
Yeah.
And I was a journalist, and everything was censored. It was a very risky time. I ended up doing things that were forbidden, like hiding people, smuggling information, that kind of stuff, which many people did. I wasn't the only one. But then there was a point where I was afraid, and then I didn't want my children to grow up like in a place like that. And we got out thinking that it would be for a very short time, because Chile was the longest and most solid democracy in Latin America. We never expected a military coup, let alone a dictatorship. It lasted 17 years. So a whole generation of Chileans left. And when they came back, in most cases, they couldn't come back with their children or their grandchildren. So there were many losses and families that were broken. I remained abroad. I remained first in Venezuela and then here in the United States. I go back to Chile all the time, but my mother returned alone with my stepfather because all her children and her grandchildren did not return.
In these times in our country, we've had the issue of torture come up so much, the issue of Abu Ghraib, and then whether torture could possibly be legal. And I thought that Chile is a country that has lived with torture. And what is your advice to Americans who could contemplate that it could be okay to torture?
I cannot imagine how anybody can be okay with torture for any reason whatsoever. First of all, it's not efficient. The information you get is not true. People will say anything because they are in awful pain. Torture humiliates and degrades and breaks the person who is tortured, but also the victimizer. You become a rotten human being, and you carry that for the rest of your life. A country that allows torture breaks something essential in the soul of the country. So I am absolutely appalled at the fact that any politician or anybody in this country can say that torture is okay.
And you've written in some cases in Chile, there would be a victim of torture living in the same building 20 years later with the torturer.
The president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, her father was a general who did not comply with the coup and was killed by his peers in torture. Then she, who was 15, and her mother were arrested, and they were also tortured. Eventually, they got out of the country, and they made a life somewhere else in Germany. When this woman returned as a doctor, started working against the dictatorship, and then she became eventually the president of Chile. And she meets in the elevator her torturer in the building where she lives. Eventually, the guy left. But that's the kind of thing that can happen, that you go to the market and you meet the person who has killed your husband or raped you. or disappeared your daughter.
Yes, yeah, so how can a society...
You can't.
Yeah.
You can't heal that kind of thing.
Yes. Now, she is quite a remarkable
she's
woman.
She's a remarkable woman.
She's a physician and...
She's a socialist, a single mother, a doctor, atheist, which in Chile, that is a very Catholic country, is unheard of. So it's very unique that we have a woman president like that.
And what way is Latin America going now? You have the other female president?
Yeah, Cristina in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
They say that Latin America is going left. I think that the left has changed. It's not the same left as the 1970s, except in Venezuela, where Chavez is still fixed with the ideas of the 70s. But most countries are trying to work out a political system that will be neoliberal or capitalist in the economy and yet take care of people. Because when there is great inequality, great poverty, when you have a sector of the population that is marginalized, that does not participate in the economy like it happens in many countries, you cannot have pure capitalism, because then you have the richer getting richer and controlling everything, and the poor totally abandoned, and the middle class suffering more and more. And by the way, that's happening in this country too, that you have a middle class that has been impoverished, poor people that have no health insurance, that are not taken care of. So we have to be very careful with these things. You cannot do things in black and white. There are grays in between.
Speaking of putting things in black and white, I want to talk, if you would speak with us a little about your techniques for writing. I know that you start a book on a magical day for you, January 8th, and then you kind of hole up while you're writing. Tell us a little about your process for writing.
I start on January 8th now for discipline. At the beginning, it was superstition. It was a good day for me because I started The House of the Spirits on a January 8th, and it was a lucky book. So just for Kabbalah, I kept the day. But then my life became really complicated because, you know, it's not only writing the books, it's all the research. Then you have to go around the world selling it like if you were selling rugs. You have to do the millions of interviews and travel all over and the book tours and all that. So for discipline, I clear my calendar 6 months a year. And starting January 8th, I don't do anything until the summer. And that's the time when I can get out.
The memoir is so important for us to read. I mean, I really felt like I was part of your family. Talk to us a little about the letters that you and your mother have exchanged for how many years?
Oof, a lifetime. The first time I was separated from my mother, I was 15. And then in different moments in our life, we have been separated, but most of our lives we have not lived in the same country. And she established very early on the habit of writing to me every single day. When she was living in Turkey, the letters would take 2 months. And then we faxed, and then we emailed, and now we went back to the mail. And it doesn't matter how long it takes, but we still write each other every day. I like to see her handwriting. I like the envelope with the stamp. And I have collected her letters, and she gives me back my own letters at the end of the year. And I know that when she dies, I will be able to open a letter from my mother every day for the rest of my life.
And in the end of The House of the Spirits, the mother gives to the daughter this little bundles also of letters,
yeah,
you know, to explain, you know, her past, even when she wasn't there, her mother's journals of everything that happened.
You know, letters are very important for women. In the literary world, in history, women have no voice. It's only recently that some of us have some voice, and we speak for those who have been silenced for centuries. But we express ourselves in letters. There are beautiful letters written by women. And my mother, who is a wonderful writer, an intelligent woman, but belongs to a generation and a time and a place where she couldn't do anything with her life, expresses all her soul and her life and her ideas in these fabulous letters. And it's a treasure for me. If my house burnt, I would save the dog first and then the letters.
Well, I hope that your house never burns, because you have built in Northern California a house that is very much like the house of the spirits.
My husband built a house thinking of the house of the spirits. And, of course, it's much better than the house of the spirits ever was.
And yet you feel it is also populated by all the people you've ever loved.
Yeah, I believe that the memories are there. And if you really remember people, they live with you. I don't see the ghost of my grandmother moving the three-legged table. I don't see Paula roaming around in a white gown with wings. No, but their photographs are everywhere. They are in my altar. I write about them. I think about them. I talk to them all the time. They are with me. So that's my way of living with the spirits.
And you address, I want to show again a few of your books. This is her book this year, The Sum of Our Days, which is addressed to her daughter. And I just had such a sense of her presence, and then knowing all about you and your families. And then what started it all, we've gone backwards, but The House of the Spirits, for anyone who hasn't read this, although 51 million...
I would say don't read it, just watch the movie.
Oh.
Antonio Banderas is in the
movie. Oh, well, of course. Oh, thank you so
much.
Thank
you, Rina.
Our guest today is the famous writer Isabel Allende. Again, thank you for joining us.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Lorene Mills, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're going to take a break now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Our guests today are a marvelous couple and two brilliant writers. Isabel Allende, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And her wonderful husband, Willie Gordon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me give a little background. I think most people know you, Isabel, but you've come to Santa Fe as guest of the Landon Foundation and did a dazzling presentation. You are a world-famous author. You've sold over 51 million copies of your books. They're available in 30 languages. Your first book that was such a sensation is The House of the Spirits. There are many, many others. I won't show them all. But one that we will dwell on today, Of Love and Shadows.
That was my second novel.
Your second novel, and it has a lot to do with how you two met. You'll tell us the story in a minute. Your most recent book is this wonderful memoir called The Sum of Our Days. And we'll look at some of your other books like Aphrodite, things like that in a minute. But 20 years ago, you had the delightful pleasure of meeting Willie. And so, welcome to Santa Fe.
Excuse me, he had the delightful pleasure of meeting me.
Exactly. But perhaps it was one of those happy serendipitous where you both were lucky to meet each other.
Fate.
You are, in your professionally, you've started out as a lawyer and a community activist, which has gotten sort of fallen.
I love the term, me and Obama.
Yes, and you have recently started to write. Your website says International Man of Mysteries in both senses of the word. So you've written a couple of mysteries, The Chinese Jars and The King of the Bottom.
King of the Bottom, yes.
Yes, and you're working on more. And so here we have two wonderful people who also write and maybe... but first I want you to tell me what this book... Of Love and Shadows has to do with how you two met.
And you have to tell the story.
You've told me that there are 50 versions of the story, so you may give us any one of the 50.
Well, I'm going to tell you because she has too many stories about how this happened. I, on my 50th birthday, a very good friend of mine, Celia Zapata, who's a professor of Latin American literature at San Jose State, gave me this book, Of Love and Shadows, to read. And she said it was time that I got involved in... Latin American literature. So I took it to Italy with me and I read it. And I wrote a postcard that I really wanted to meet this author because she talked about love the same way that I perceived it. So when I got back, I called her and I said, well, then, did you get my postcard? And she said, you liar, you never sent me a postcard. And that was the end of our conversation. And then 2 days later, she called me and says, I got your postcard. And if you want to meet Isabel, you have to be down here in 2 days because she's going to be here. So I went. And I met Isabel, and we had dinner, and I don't know, the bell sounded, and we never really left each other after that.
Now, the magicians say it's all done with mirrors, so mm-hmm. I'm going to have the reflection of that story mm-hmm. from Isabel's point of view.
I was in a book tour, running around, as book tours usually are. And I never do any social life at all. I don't go out with strangers when I'm in a book tour. But that night, I had a dream. And in the dream was this man that I had met at dinner. And so when he invited me the next day for lunch, I went out with him because I had had the dream. And we hooked up. I asked him to tell me the story of his life. And I fell in love with the story and in lust with the man, who was the last heterosexual bachelor in San Francisco, and he was available. I had been divorced for three months, so I really needed a guy. So I thought, just for one night, and then here I am, 20 years later.
I think that the dreaded word commitment came up early in the relationship.
Well, because, you know, I had been married for a long time, and I thought that when you sort of fall in love with someone, it's for marriage. And I asked him immediately the next day, when he was driving me to the airport, do we have some kind of commitment? And he had to pull over. He almost fainted. What did you say?
No.
No. He said no, and I said, well, I don't have any time to waste. So I took the plane and decided to forget him. But I couldn't, so I came back without an invitation because he didn't like me that much, and he was terrified. And after a week or so, I stayed and stayed and stayed. And then I needed a green card, so I forced him into marriage. Yeah, that's true.
Now, when you told your son about this relationship, what did he say?
When I said that I had fallen in love with a guy in the tour, and he said, at your age? I was 45.
And you had gone, if I may go back to your, one of your first jobs, where you were translating romance novels from English into Spanish, and you had the chutzpah, you had the nerve to change some of the heroine's characteristics so they were more independent, and you even changed the endings somehow. And you have said that sometimes you don't believe in happy endings, but do we have a happy ending?
Well, we have a happy continuum, let's put it that way.
That's lovely. That's
but also, it has not been easy. Yeah, we both come from very different cultures, and we've had a lot of problems. So I think that...
We're surviving. It's okay.
And you've also suffered, both of you, terrible losses early in the relationship.
You talk about that.
Yeah, we both lost our daughters. Very painful. And that's something you never really get over.
No. But it's something in many cases will separate people.
It
and
does.
In your cases...
It's probably worse if you have the child together... what I've seen, but my daughter was involved in drugs, so I always knew that she was going to have not a happy end. So.
You know, they say that the universe conspires to help you when you are in a project like this, and it really has happened to both of us. Mm-hmm. We work at home in the same place and at the same time, but we are never in each other's faces, and we share stories, but we don't get involved in each other's books. So he just finished a third novel that a lot of people have already read. He hasn't shown it to me yet. And he hasn't read my book that I just finished.
Well, I know that your regime, your writing regime, is
brutal.
Formidable.
Brutal.
That you start on the magical day of January 8th, and you clear your calendar, and you hole up and do all your research and write and rewrite. I mean, it really is grueling.
Mm-hmm.
Is your schedule so demanding? Is it?
No, what happens is that I carry her bags everywhere in the world that she goes, and I write when I can. I write in airports, I write in bathrooms, I write in hotel lobbies, my books have been written in every country that we've been in the world, because I write by hand, and then I put it in the computer later, and then I have a totally different regime, and I'm so hyper anyway. That, as Isabel says, I can only sit down for 11 minutes at a time anyway.
I've learned so much about you through your memoirs, the magnificent book, Paula, about your daughter. And then, again, I want to show this one, The Sum of Our Days, because you wrote it, the structure was sort of a letter to Paula to
tell her what had happened with our family.
With the family.
Yeah.
And for us, the readers, it's so intimate. And you say at one point that... it's not the secrets that you... No, it's not the truth that you tell that makes you vulnerable. It's the secrets that you don't tell that make you vulnerable. There are not many secrets even to be read here. It's true you gave your family members the choice to opt in or opt out, and when they opted out, you had to redo the whole thing.
Yeah.
But how comfortable is it for your family to have their lives novelistically and brilliantly portrayed?
You know, what has happened is that, for example, my daughter-in-law, Lori, is a very private person, and she was just appalled at the idea that her life would be out there. But she accepted to be in the book, and she found out after the book was published that many people come to her, people she has never met in her life, stop her in the street, to share with her either the problems that are similar or just tell her about or ask questions. And it's always with a good intention, always with kindness. She has never had a bad encounter of any kind. And I think that that's very reassuring.
And for you, Willie, to have the Infinite Plan, this book about your family and your life, but not, of course, a memoir, but a fictionalized version, did she fall in love with your story before she fell in love with you?
I don't know. That's what she says.
And then how do you... This novel is so... it's so universal. It's so all-encompassing. How are you happy with it? And is it what you would have done? You let her write it.
Well, obviously, it's her story. But emotionally, it's a very true story. I mean, the facts are changed to protect the innocent, as they say. But it's a very emotionally true story, and I'm very happy with it.
Tell us a little about the story.
If you look in my website, there's
WilliamCGordon.com,
and there's a biography of me. And basically, it's what you find if you read The Infinite Plan. My father was a wild Australian. He was a painter, a writer. He invented a religion called The Infinite Plan. And he even came through... Santa Fe and through Albuquerque in the late 30s and the early 40s, and I was with him. My first trip through here was in 1940, and I remember very distinctly in Albuquerque they sent me to a daycare center, and I crapped in my pants, and I didn't want to tell anybody, but they were badgering me, and I remember that, and it was snowing outside. And denying it.
I denied it,
but anyway, it was $1 to get in. And my father would then dress in a tuxedo with a spotlight on him in a tent, and he would talk and talk and talk with an orange hanging from a thread on the ceiling. And then people would leave, and they'd have to buy The Infinite Plan, which was $1 also. So, and for a boy, I mean, if you live in a place, you live in a little community, the world was our community. And so I had this tremendous sense of freedom and adventure, and that's the kind of guy he was. So for all his faults and all his baloney, he gave me a gift, the gift of freedom. And it was an incredible thing. And the idea is that there aren't any limits to what you can do. You just do it. I mean, he was a man who had no education, no money, but he still did everything he wanted to do. And that's the lesson I learned.
So I imagine you, with your novelistic consciousness, hearing this story of his life and going...
Yeah, but also I didn't know anything about the United States, and this seemed to me like a very California story, the story of a time. The things that he had lived represented in my mind so much what had happened in the country during the time of the Vietnam War, the civil rights, the gay movement, all the things that happened in Willie's life were very, very like cliches almost for me as a foreigner. So I was fascinated. And I was fascinated with the place, with California also.
And you live in Northern California together, and you have sort of recreated a Chilean country home.
Well, that's Isabel.
No, but he built the house. We have put together a family with people who are not even blood related. But we feel that we are a little tribe. And then at one point, Willie was obsessed with building a house that would look like his idea of the House of the Spirits. And so he built a house on top of a hill that looks very Spanish or Chilena from the countryside. And it's been like a place where we all gather. It's like the center of this little tribe.
And your life is, in effect, seasonal. Winter you spend writing from January until the summer you spend writing. And then it's, you know, the tribe. It's
and then it's the extroverted time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. When we have the tribe and we have to travel and do all the promotion of the books and all that. But it's a very interesting life. We can't complain, and we are still healthy. We are old, but healthy.
No, you're not old.
Older.
He always says, every morning he says to me, we are falling apart together. And I said, no, you are falling apart. I'm growing old.
Believe me, we're falling apart together.
Well, what are the challenges of working together and maintaining a relationship?
Actually, we don't work together, and we I'm a hack.
Parallel.
I grew up with Earl Stanley Gardner and Ellery Queen and Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. I'm a mystery writer, and she helped me get to that place, and that my mind works that way. And I'm a lawyer, and so I'm always
she puts pieces together.
And she talks about the big saga, as I was telling somebody last night. She talks about the big saga, and I take the minutia, the little guy, and out of that, if there's anything universal, it comes out of the littleness of people. And she does this big, expansive thing. So we don't compete. I tell everybody who wants to know, I say, I'm just a flea on the elephant's ass. And then
Excuse
they get
me.
Angry, and then I say, well, okay, I'm a fly on this queen's skirt.
So, that looks, sounds better.
Yes, it certainly does.
So it's not a matter of competition, and we just work so differently. And I get my inspiration. We probably get our inspiration from the same place. You get it from a newspaper. You're looking for something, and the universe conspires, and it drops it in your lap. But that happens to every writer.
So you really work with mysteries or genre, yeah. And you work with the cosmic mystery.
Exactly.
Because you say in your books, there's always room for the unknown. There's always room for mystery, the grand
but,
mystery.
But the daily routine is interesting because it's a dance in which we are together without stepping on each other's toes. I never have the feeling that he's on my face. I don't know if I'm
no,
on your face.
Happen.
But we just dance around each other with a dog in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it works wonderful.
In your early relationship, you had mentioned you had faxed him a contract.
Yeah.
Dare you tell us a little about that?
Well, when we met and I had to finish the tour, and he told me that we had no commitment, I went home and my son said that, why don't you just go and spend some time with him and take him out of your system and go on with your life? And I thought it was a very good idea, and I had a fax. There were no cellulars at the time, and so or no emails or any of that kind of stuff. So I faxed him a sort of contract with the kind of stuff that I wanted from a relationship in a column, and a much shorter column with a few things I was willing to give. And he thought it was very funny. And being a lawyer, he signed it and sent it back. Big mistake.
But there was also, listen, I also wrote her a letter in my hand on the yellow pad and saying that I had been waiting for her for 50 years. But I didn't know what that meant other than the fact that I had been waiting for her for 50 years. And now I wanted to find out what's going to happen because who knows what's going to happen? You never know. But so it wasn't exactly like I was just, you know, making a joke out of it. I was serious, but it was an unknown area.
But the recognition you had from who she was in writing of Love and Shadows, that was like your magnetic needle.
Absolutely.
Turned north and said, this is it.
Absolutely.
But you know, something really interesting happened at the beginning of our relationship. Willie is a man that has been very wounded in his life. He lost his father when he was 6. And from that moment on, he was alone. He had to take care of himself from age 6 on. And he had bad relationships, bad marriages, partners that betrayed him, women that didn't work, and children that were a mess. So he had been very wounded and very betrayed. And so when we got together, one of the very first things that I said is, look, I'm never going to harm you on purpose. If it happens, it's because I make a mistake. and your back is covered. So all your fights are out there, not with me, because I'm in the back covering your back. And he believed me. In spite of all the stuff that had happened in his life, he did believe me. And I really meant it. And I think that changed his attitude with me, and he sort of surrendered to take the risk and just see if it would work. But without that surrendering, it would have never worked.
How hard was it for you to surrender?
It was hard. I mean, you know.
Was the little voice saying, it'll happen again?
I was 50 years old, and, you know, I've been through the mess she's just talked about. So, but it's been, that's happened to both of us. You go along and you come to a an obstacle that's in the, it's like the door jam, and you say, I have to get over this. And then you take a chance and you say, okay, I'll step into this next room and let's see what happens. And so you go through a series of passages where you get to the door jam and then you sort of...
But in all love relationships, there has to be history. I think that I was in a hurry. I wanted passion. I wanted love. I wanted marriage. I wanted everything immediately. And Willie was very cautious. And he always said from the very beginning, just wait. Let's see how it happens. We need history. And it is true. You need to look back and say, wow, we've been together all these years, and we have overcome all these obstacles somehow. So you gain strength, you know, muscle for the relationship.
You have created this tribe of people around you, your extended family. And as I read your memoirs, I see how important family is to you. That you have your series of letters to your mother, hundreds and hundreds of letters. The House of the Spirits was started as a letter to your grandfather. So how are you chronicling these ongoing, as you create your history, how are you chronicling it past the memoirs? Do you keep journals?
The letter to my mother every day. So I write to her every day what has happened in the day. And in a way, I know that it is not lost. Someday, it will be back in the closet. And if I need to write in 10 years what has happened, I will go to those packages of letters and go through the events and remember the feelings of the moment, which is so important because in time, we may remember what happened. We don't remember what we felt, really. And we change it in our minds also. So the daily letter is really important for me. When my mother, who is 88, dies, I don't know what I'm going to do. I need to find another person to write a letter every day to.
Well, in the sum of our days, you were still writing to Paula, your daughter.
Yeah.
So I think you'll be able to
continue
that wonderful, fluid process. And you, really.
Well, I don't think I would have been able to write if I hadn't met Isabel and learned from her several technical things about writing, and then about family. Mm-hmm. Because if you ever do read any of my books, you'll see that there's a family created by the characters. And I didn't understand that before our relationship. And so I felt very isolated and very alone, and all my searching was by a lonely character sort of walking in a wasteland. And this idea of family and connection to community and everything made it possible for me to put everything together.
Well, we thank you. We've run out of
thank
time
you.
For bringing your family to us in Santa Fe.
Thank you very much, Irina.
I want to just show some of your books. Alas, I didn't have time to find yours. But Isabel of Love and Shadows.
They made a movie, by the way, so don't read the book. Watch the movie.
They also made a wonderful movie of
The House of the Spirits. Yes.
And her most recent book, The Sum of Our Days. And Willie, your books, The Chinese Jar, The King of the Bottom.
And The Ugly Dwarf.
But they are not in English, unfortunately.
Oh, they will be.
Yeah, yeah. I hope so.
Yes. So I want to thank you. Our guests today are Willie Gordon, thank you, and his wonderful wife, Isabella.
Thank you.